Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 89. It's Saturday, November 21st. I am recording this show from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio. COVID-19 rages on, with ratings that can only enrage our narcissist-in-chief. Okay, well, I hate to say it, but I'm having a real crisis here with how to report in real time, in a real-time crisis with a pre-recorded show. Now, I love to stick to principles of public health and teach for the long run, and I hope you can get that out of the show, but it really is tough. And my question that I've asked myself this week is, can you die of deja vu? Seems like we have deja vu all over again. Too little, too late, over and over again. Okay, well, let's just cover a couple quick touchstones of where we're at with this epidemic in Ohio. This from WTVG. Franklin County turns purple, becomes first level 4 COVID county in Ohio. Franklin County, home to Ohio's capital, becomes the first county in the state to reach level 4 on the Ohio Public Health Advisory System. Franklin County has surpassed 6 of the 7 benchmarks that Ohio is using to monitor the spread of COVID-19. It has flirted with a designation in the past, but officially became purple Thursday after hospital admission data met the criteria. Well, if you look at that map, like a lot of other maps, look at the entire country, and you see that the color-coding systems we had for earlier the epidemic have kind of maxed out. It's looking very red, and I suppose with the new Ohio system, we'll be looking very purple. Okay, well, last week I confessed to you that COVID-19 pandemic is really scaring me, and I don't scare easily, so I'd like to reflect a little bit on that. Partly because in the political environment, that's one of the things what the right-wingers are saying, you know, don't be afraid of this and stuff. And there is a legitimate concern about fear versus concern. But the image that comes to mind for me is careening on a rickety roller coaster that doesn't have any seatbelts or things to hold you down. And you know that when you get to the end of that ride, there's going to be some people that are either hurled from it to their death, or severely injured, or losing arms or limbs, not being able to keep them in the car. And of course, the worst case scenario that the whole roller coaster going on a turn just goes off and crashes and kills many, many people. That's the image that kind of comes to mind. And the thing is, we've reached a point that really is uncharted, and we don't know where we're going. And I think the shift that we're going to see from just simple pandemic fatigue is, as we start seeing hospitals overwhelmed, it is going to start exceeding our normal ability to cope with risks. And that normal, healthy levels of appropriately gauging concern are just going to be overwhelmed. And I think that's fearful. You know, if you're on a roller coaster and you have a 1 or 2 or 5 or 10% chance of dying, you probably should be afraid more than just concerned. I don't know. I wouldn't. I'm not a very fearful person. But I would say if you thought pandemic fatigue was a bummer, just wait for post-traumatic stress syndrome. Okay, well, hang on. I do promise I have a good news story later on in the show. about how the Cherokee Nation is successfully dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic. And this is really cool because it is literally a nation within a nation. The Cherokee Nation is a sovereign nation that exists completely surrounded by these somewhat united states. So stay tuned for that. Okay, well, back to how we're doing locally, nationally, and statewide from the Columbus Dispatch. Ohio sets new record with 8,808 new coronavirus cases. This is yesterday, Friday. New coronavirus cases hit a new record on Friday as Ohioans headed into their first weekend under Governor Mike DeWine's mandated statewide overnight curfew. The state reported 8,808 new cases on Friday, eclipsing the 8,071 record set a week ago. Ohio had hovered around 7,000 to 8,000 cases a day over the last week, but that represents a significant jump from just 3 weeks ago when the state had fewer than 4,000 new cases. Friday's record new cases, up from 7,787 on Thursday, doesn't account for a backlog of about 12,000 less reliable rapid antigen tests that the state is double-checking. The state always verifies those tests, but the number performed on a daily basis has exploded from hundreds to thousands, making it difficult to check within 24 hours. And just to be sure, when they say exploding from hundreds to thousands, that means hundreds to thousands of positive tests, not total tests. So they do a confirmatory test because the antigen tests are not as accurate as the standard of the PCR test. Okay, well, similarly, Lucas County smashed through and set its new record yesterday, Friday, with over 400 newly identified cases. And similarly, nationally, we hit almost 200,000 cases. The daily 7-day average is now at about 169,000 every day. And just to note, historical perspective, if you consider history a week or two, higher than daily record of 143,000 from 10 days ago. So 10 days ago, we set a new daily high of 143,000. Now, 10 days later, our 7-day average is 169,000 a day. This is still careening out of control. And I would note, you're going to see, and it looks like I can see in some of the states, you're seeing a little blunting of the upward. I don't think this necessarily has anything to do or very little to do with the response that we're having to it. A lot of this is that the numbers, the testing numbers and the positivity numbers are being shunted by increasing limits on testing. It's the Trump effect. If you can't test, you can't identify new infections. Of course, they're still there. And we've known since the beginning of this epidemic that for every positive test, you might have 3, 4, 5, 6, 10 additional positives, depending on your testing regimen and how well you're reaching into the community and identifying new infections. Okay, well, I wanted to spend a little time since I've hit that theme of too little, too late often in my show over the past months, and I just wanted to reflect on that a bit. So, too little, what does that mean? Well, I wanted to go back to a concept I've talked about numerous times on the show, but not recently. That's the thing called R-naught, which is simply a mathematical or epidemiological term for the reproductive rate of the virus, meaning for every person that infected, on average, how many people will be infected by that person. If it's one, that means the epidemic just continues. One person gets it, then they give it to another person, then that person gives it to another person, and that person gives it to another person. So when it's exactly one, your epidemic doesn't grow, but it just stays the same. It just keeps passing it around. If you have it under one, then it'll shrink. You know, you have 100 people give it to 100 people, then 100 people give it to 80, then 80 give it to 60, then 60 give it to 30, you know, that kind of, and it shrinks if the R-naught is below one. Now, of course, if it's over one, which is what we're experiencing now, then it grows. And the weird thing is, the scary thing is that it grows exponentially. It's easier to go up than it is down. That's one of the tough things about dealing with a pandemic, particularly when it gets out of control like we're in right now. So for instance, if you had 100 people and you had one person infected, and assuming that, you know, say over, say a 5 days, a period, which is usually counts a couple days or so that you might be infectious, that you're going to infect whatever people you're going to infect, kind of the generation. If you, that's 5 days, so you'd have six of them in a month. If you had an R of exactly one, where one person gives it to one, you know, you're going to end up with like five or six people that have had COVID by the end of the month. If that R value is two, in other words, for every person who gets it, they give it to two people, then those two people give it to four, those four people give it to eight, those eight people give it to 16, those 16 give it to 32, those 32 give it to 64. That is six generations. So out of 100 people in that case, you would have 64 infected at that rate. Yikes. So you can see it's easier to go up. And of course, you have it below, you know, you can take it from five total cases down to two. But then again, if you let up, then that two can multiply up really quickly again. That's why it's really was really important. We're way past that stage now. There is no place in this country, no state in this country that has levels low enough where you can really suppress it down to something near zero. We are in uncontrolled community spread virtually everywhere. Okay, so that's R naught, very important. And so the basic question is, can we get that down to somewhere near one, or actually quite a bit below? Because if we get it around one, that means we're going to hang out the levels we have, like, you know, indefinitely until, you know, enough people get infected that you get that so-called stupid herd immunity from disease, not herd immunity from a vaccine, which is not a good scenario. Okay, so the thing we need to understand about where we're at now than say we were when this was novel in the spring, because the spring was the end of flu season, the last part of flu season. So we really lucked out with the timing there. But the layers of protection that we need changes, and it actually goes up in the winter during flu season. Okay, let me back up just a second. I want to say one more thing about R naught. R naught is not a universal constant that's unchanging. It's dependent on the social conditions, the physical and biological environment. It's kind of the sum total of that, and what do those conditions lead to how much reproduction. Now, of course, some of that does depend on the characteristics of the virus, which are relatively stable, although there's some evidence that we have a new strain that may be more infectious and actually replicates in the body faster, so you may actually get infected and get illness a day earlier, although that illness may not be any more severe. It shortens the reproduction generation or cycle that you would have perhaps from person to person as well, which can increase the multiplication. Okay, so there's a whole bunch of layers that we need to protect ourselves. And if we do those exact same layers that worked in the spring, that may not be enough to actually work now. Okay, which is scary. So we're going to have to actually do more than we do in the spring to bring it down. And if we do enough to make it below one, it'll actually be less effective than what it would have been if you'd done it in the spring, because we have other things working against us. We're going to have people inside. You're going to have low humidity. The virus is going to be aerosolized easier. It survives longer in the air and on surfaces. And people's respiratory passages are more dried out and more susceptible to infection. So you add all those things together, and it is just harder to get control of this virus. Okay, so this is part of my meditation on too little, too late. This is the too little part. So here's a couple ditties, news ditties about our illustrious governor, Mike DeWine, which was, he was considering threatening, like a parent to a small child, if you don't get this, you know, straightened out in a week, you know, we're going to close bars and restaurants potentially. You know, I'll count to three, one, two, two and a half, two and three quarters, two and seven eighths. And of course, he didn't do it. Not good parenting. I don't want to say that we have a nanny state, but we do need some leadership at the top. So what did Mike DeWine settle upon? A curfew. So basically a nighttime shutdown, you know, from 10 a.m. to 5 a.m. So this is what DeWine said. We've got to get a hold of this. This is a crucial time in our battle against the virus. When asked about whether there will be more restrictions later this week, especially regarding bars and restaurants, DeWine said that while nothing is off the table, he doesn't want to shut the economy down. In another quote, a spokesman for Mr. DeWine said he believed Ohio's three-week curfew can, quote, can make a dent in states can make a dent in the state's rising cases while letting bars and restaurants continue to make money by serving people earlier in the evening. So my point here basically is that, you know, this is another one of these things where we'd like to keep the economy going, but the virus is going to shut us down if we don't do the appropriate things. But I feel for Mr. DeWine and everyone else, every political leader in the country, because we are in a tough spot, because without financial support of businesses and workers, asking people to shut down their businesses is asking a lot. But I would say it's a little bit odd, say, this week, as most of you probably know, in Ohio, Governor DeWine, or I'm sorry, the Toledo Lucas County Health Department and quite a few municipalities around Ohio have had stay-at-home advisories. So basically, bars and restaurants are open for indoor use, but we're kind of telling people don't use them. So there's a fundamental conundrum in this kind of parsed out, devolved way of dealing with the virus. And of course, states, because they can't offer the financial assistance necessary to close down businesses without putting them at financial risk, they need the federal government to do that. They're very limited in what they're really able to do. But whatever the reasons are, the answer, if it's too little, is probably yes, it is too little. Making a dent, yeah, making a dent. But if it's way too little, that's not saying much. Okay, too late, too little, too late. So what would too late be? Well, at the community level, it's never really too late. Anything you do to prevent the new infections will help. And that's never too late. Now, of course, at the individual level, it's too late to do prevention if, in fact, you are infected. Then it's too late. And oddly, I think psychologically, a lot of people who are playing what I call loosey-goosey with the virus, if they get infected, oftentimes they have their little come to Jesus moment, but of course they're already infected, so it isn't nearly as important to prevent once you've already been infected. Now, of course, we don't know how long infection provides immunity, that type of thing, but likely it provides it for at least some months at a minimum. Okay, and as far as never too late, we know that wherever we are today, that hospitalizations and deaths will lag new infections by 2 to 4 weeks. So even if we do in the next 2 or 3 weeks, like Toledo Lucas County Health Department is hoping, say we really step up to the plate and we really crank it down and people only do the absolute necessary things and minimize interactions with other folks, physical distancing, you know, the whole works, mask usage, we're still going to see 2, 3, 4 weeks of large amounts of hospitalizations and deaths, even increasing in the first 2 or 3 weeks, even if you totally crank down new infections. So there's always going to be a lag there. I think that's an optimistic take. The fact, I was pleased. I listened to the Toledo Lucas County Health Department board meeting, and it was exciting to see all of the political leaders, meaning mayors and township trustees, be on board and say, this is a crisis that we need to deal with. It's the hospital being overwhelmed that I think is getting people to really realize that this is the backstop that we have. And if that goes, we are in deep trouble. Okay. Also, with the idea of too late is kind of like when, what order or priority do we implement protections? One of the weirdest things that's happening across the country that just shows that our priorities are all messed up is that, you know, we're closing schools and we're keeping bars open and even keeping restaurants open for indoor dining. It's kind of crazy. We should be shutting that down before we shut down schools. But from that same board meeting, it's likely, and perhaps this week, we'll see some new advisories coming out of the health department asking that keeping K through 6 open, but shutting down 7 through 12 and asking university college level to do virtual only, because it does seem to be a difference in the transmission for the younger kids, and it's really important that they be in school. Okay, well, too little too late. Unfortunately, I think the good news is you probably can't die of deja vu, but it can be sort of painful. Okay, well, in other kind of news this week, the IMHE, the Institute for Metrics and Health and Evaluation, something like that, from the University of Washington, the one who does one of the big projections that was used by the White House early on when they cared about such things, has finally caught up with my projection from April or May. Back then, they were saying between 80 and 240,000 people would die in like the next 4 or 5 months. I was saying we would smash through that and be closer to by the first year of the pandemic, say through March of next year, that we would be closer to COVID-19 being the leading cause of death, which would be just under 700,000 deaths. So being closer to 700,000 than the 240, I was saying 470,000 by March. Well, that's the number this week that they're predicting by March. That's their kind of middle prediction thing. Could be worse if things get worse. Could be better if people, you know, mask up and do more stringent restrictions. So, glad to see that they're catching up. They've always been kind of behind. And they have this weird kind of assumption that, you know, what goes up must come down. I'm not sure that's the case with this virus. I think that's something about modeling that I guess that's built in. But it'll come down at some time, but it may not come down within months of the time they think it's going to. And actually, I won't be surprised if we see over 100,000 deaths in a 30-day period. And with Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's, I suspect hospitalizations and death could very well be reaching their peak somewhere around Inauguration Day. Well, President-elect Biden, you have your hands full. Okay, well, let's do the local update and drill down and see what's happening here in Lucas County, good old Toledo area. Well, our average daily cases, a 7-day average, went up from 200 to 253 this last week since I reported on last show. And like I said earlier, yesterday, Friday, we had over 400 cases, a smashing new record. Well, because of reporting glitches, they didn't report the number of cases like they normally do Monday through Friday last Friday, so I had to go back 8 days. So to look at the positivity rate, which again is the percent of tests that are done that are positive. It's not the rate of people in the population that are infected, but of only of those who are being tested. And of course, it's a measure of how much testing you're doing, because if you're doing widespread testing, it's going to be a lot lower, even given the same amount of infection. And the World Health Organization says it should be under 5%. Well, for the last 8 days, Lucas County's positivity rate was, drumroll please, 37%. Yikes. We did about 600 tests a day over those last 8 days reported, and 1,771 positives. Now, of course, like I've mentioned before, the testing numbers are a little bit skewed. They're not really lined up necessarily when they happen, particularly the negative tests. They might get a dump of those later, but over 8 days, it's going to be relatively close. So even if it was, you know, 20%, that would be shockingly bad. In fact, in Ohio, the 7-day average for positive tests in Ohio is 13.1%, you know, way higher than that recommended of under 5%. And that's up from 11.8% the week before. So in the last few weeks, we've gone from 9.4% to 11.8% to 13.1%. Seems to keep going up. But a positivity rate of anywhere near 37% is pretty disastrous for Lucas County. Give them credit that they're trying to ramp up some testing. They were doing more testing at UT for students that might be going home. There's been more pop-up sites, so testing is going up somewhat, but we still have a long ways to go. Okay. Testing, of course, is important not only for somebody knowing what to do, but for triggering contact tracing for the health department to be able to talk with that person, identify contacts, and educate that person about what they need to do. But this health department news release came out yesterday. And here's what they entitled it. Health department urges individual accountability during COVID-19. With the state experiencing a backlog of the COVID-19 data system, the sheer volume of cases paired with the prediction of increased cases in Lucas County, we are asking those who test positive to isolate and reach out to their close contacts. As noted in the Lucas County stay-at-home advisory, residents who are either confirmed positive or a close contact should not wait to hear from the health department and immediately follow isolation and quarantine guidance. Anyone who has been in close contact with someone who has had COVID-19 needs to quarantine for 14 days from the date of last exposure. Okay, well, you know, I've been asking about the state of contact tracing throughout this epidemic, and this is pretty much the red flag saying, whoops, we've been overwhelmed. The tsunami has come over the barrier, and we are getting wet. That urges individual accountability is, I suppose, maybe a nice way of just saying, well, we're not there for you anymore. We can't handle the wash of positives that's coming over. And in a related thing is, even if we had an infinite amount of staff to do contact tracing, we are seeing that the testing results turnaround is going up. It went up almost a day. Now, this is just for positive results. It might take longer for a negative result to get back because they prioritize notifying the person who's positive and the health department with positive tests. But the turnaround for positive tests, which are prioritized, is about 4 days. And this is likely to go up again as labs are overwhelmed. Okay, well, let's look at long-term care facilities or nursing homes. Here we saw that we jumped from 93 to 134 active cases. That's 58 residents and 76 staff, which is pretty much proportional to the increases we're seeing in the community. So I guess that's to be expected, but of course it's terrible news because this is one of the most vulnerable populations and the hardest hit in this pandemic. And as another indicator of how we're being overwhelmed there, even with testing, the positivity rate for testing bumped up to 14.6% in the long-term care facilities, a very targeted population that we're trying to do lots of testing to prevent transmission. So in the last 3 weeks, it's gone from 6.7% in long-term care facilities to 9.9% to 14.6% of those being tested in long-term care facilities coming back as positive. Okay, well, UT has been doing their testing, and they bumped up from 53 to 72 identified new infections. Their surveillance testing last week only had 1.4% positive, which is actually a little lower than what they've been running. So it does seem that UT, while it's going up, which you expect it's going up in the community, doesn't seem to be a huge driver if testing is representative of what's actually happening. Which we'll just, let's assume for goodness sakes, just that it is. It doesn't seem that that the UT college campus community is driving the epidemic. It's just all over the place. But way to go, UT, I guess, relatively speaking. Okay, well, let's look at the other schools. We're seeing similarly an increase in infections in Lucas County schools. So this is both public and private schools in Lucas County. We had 87 staff in the most recent week and 96 students that test positive. That's up from 61 staff and 50 students the prior week. So we are definitely seeing an increase, but of course there is no standardized regular testing in the schools, no regular protocols of testing. This is just people who for whatever reason think they were exposed to somebody or have symptoms that would get tested through the regular community process. But that is going up as well. And of course, like Toledo Public Schools and a lot of the public schools have been doing remote or hybrid. Toledo Public Schools has been doing hybrid just a couple days a week for students. So it's kind of half and half. But like I mentioned earlier, for the 7 through 12 grades, we might see a recommendation to do remote since those ages, grades 7 to 12, seem to resemble adults as far as transmission. Okay, well, let's move on to more national news and look at another state. One state I've been looking at closely through the epidemic is Iowa. They've had a pretty recalcitrant Republican governor and senator who have been not at all interested in doing the traditional public health measures to close down the virus here. And we've got this from NBC News. It's not enough. Health experts say Ohio governor's new COVID-19 order is weak. Over the past few weeks, Dana Jones has grown increasingly alarmed at how Iowans are handling COVID-19, with hospitals running out of intensive care unit beds and the state surpassing a 45% positivity rate. So Jones, a nurse in Iowa City, initially felt relieved to hear Monday that Governor Kim Reynolds would sign a proclamation that included a statewide mask mandate. But then she read it. The proclamation only requires face coverings in public when someone is within 6 feet of other people for 15 minutes or more. And there are a number of exceptions. Bars and restaurants can stay open but have to close by 10 p.m. And masks are not required for people exercising in gyms. So just to do a little editorial comment here. So basically, if you're going to a retail establishment and you're mixing around with God knows how many people, if you're not actually by that same person, I guess, less than 6 feet for 15 minutes or more, you don't have to wear a mask. I mean, this is the weakest face mask mandate I have ever seen. Okay, back to the story. It's not enough, said Jones, 39. I know it's better than nothing, and at this point I'll take anything we can get, but I was frustrated there were so many carve-outs because I'm so afraid I just don't know what these coming months will bring. Iowa has the third highest rate of new COVID-19 cases nationally, behind North and South Dakota. The entire state of Iowa, like much of the Midwest, is in the red zone, according to the latest White House Coronavirus Task Force report, meaning there's a high rate of positive cases. Iowa saw a record 39 coronavirus deaths Wednesday, according to an NBC News tally. Health professionals say the crisis is worsening, but testing remains hard to find in Iowa, and elected officials are still only taking baby steps in terms of mitigation efforts, leaving doctors and public health experts afraid the situation won't improve in the near future. At a November 12th meeting, the Ohio State Board of Health, a mostly Republican body appointed by the governor, voted 7-2 to urge Reynolds to issue a mask mandate. Face coverings had been discussed in previous meetings, but two board members said in emails this week that as public health groups raised concerns about the increasing severity of the pandemic in Iowa, the board voted to recommend a mask mandate, hoping it would convince people to wear masks. Last weekend, the White House Coronavirus Task Force also urged Iowa's government to implement stricter mask measures, test teachers and students in schools, and pause extracurricular school activities. Federal officials told Iowa to expand the state's free public testing sites to target young people and to find asymptomatic carriers. Reynolds responded with her proclamation late Monday. She amended it Wednesday to permit group exercise classes. "It's too weak and comes with too many loopholes," said Dr. Machihiko Goto, an infectious disease specialist at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. "But what bothers me most is the way she's communicating the message to people in Iowa." Reynolds said in a Tuesday press conference that there's science on both sides of whether wearing a mask is effective at preventing the spread of the coronavirus, and noted that other states had already had mandates were also seeing rising cases. She also did not urge Iowans to stay home. "It makes it challenging because then people say they don't know who to trust or what to believe," said Danielle Petty Majewski, the public health director in Washington County. Petty Majewski said that while public health officials regularly plan for steps to take in a disease outbreak, what we don't plan for is this disjointed response from our government. "As high as the case counts are in Iowa, health experts fear that there are many more that are not being detected because testing is severely limited. The state set up a network of free testing sites called Test Iowa, but after closing multiple locations, there are now just 26 across the state with limited appointments." Reynolds said last week that the state will spend $3.4 million to purchase additional tests. But in the meantime, Petty Majewski said they're missing asymptomatic carriers who continue to spread the disease without knowing they have it. Other states like California have widespread testing available to anyone who thinks they've been exposed. "It means we are constantly running uphill," she said. "We're always behind, and we see that. We see our hospitals filling up. We see our case numbers skyrocketing. We know we can't stop this. We just keep stressing that people can only change this with their behavior."
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you. at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me, but the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch. And I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, well, in some good news, even business is beginning to realize and step up their game as for calling for COVID restrictions in order to be able to keep businesses opening. This dichotomy of either open the economy or suppress the virus, these are not two ends of one spectrum. They are intricately linked. And of course, businesses, groups recognize that. This from The Hill. Business group calls for national mask mandate, COVID-19 relief. The Business Roundtable, a group of CEOs from major U.S. companies, is calling for a slew of immediate government actions to address the rapidly growing COVID-19 pandemic and its economic consequences, including a national mask mandate and action on a relief bill. It's not as though it's either safety or economic recovery. There's no economic recovery without safety, the group's president, Joshua Bolton, told reporters. In remarks that were critical of the Trump administration's response to the pandemic without directly mentioning the president, Bolton laid out a slew of priorities to get the pandemic under control and boost businesses. In addition to a national mask mandate, Bolton said the government needs to issue clear safety guidelines for businesses, implement a national testing strategy, and re-engage with the World Health Organization. President Trump has long been skeptical of masks, opting to let states make key decisions on the pandemic instead of setting federal standards. And he withdrew from the World Health Organization. Bolton also said that one of the most critical things for the economy would be immediate action by Congress on another relief measure. We're in the "it should be enacted now" camp, he said, when asked whether such a bill could wait until after the new year. What we're talking about here is important economic relief for people who are hurting, and a lot of economic damage can be done the next 2 or 3 months before the next Congress can get going. Bolton told reporters that Congress should start with a more limited deal to address the recent surge in COVID-19 infections and need to prepare for properly distributing a vaccine and build on it with a broader bill focused on shoring up the recovery early in President-elect Biden's administration. The immediate bill, he said, should still include support for small businesses, struggling families, schools, and efforts to close the digital divide. Well, I think for me, the canary in the coal mine is, of course, the whole masking issue, which is about the easiest thing you can ask somebody to do that could do a lot of good. It's a low-hanging fruit, you know, and if in our social fabric we're not able to do the low-hanging fruit, it doesn't bode well for the other measures that might help. Okay, well, let's take a look at what's happening with hospitals. Our final backstop. This from Stat News. People are going to die. Hospitals in half the states are facing a massive staffing shortage as COVID-19 surges. Hospitals in at least 25 states are critically short of nurses, doctors, and other staff as coronavirus cases surge across the United States, according to the industry's trade association and a tally conducted by STAT. The situation has gotten so bad that in some places, severely ill patients have been transferred hundreds of miles for an available bed, from Texas to Arizona and from central Missouri to Iowa. Many of these hospitals spent months building up stockpiles of medical equipment and protective gear in response to COVID-19, but the supplies are of little use without adequate staffing. Care is about more than a room with a hospital bed. It's about medical professionals taking care of patients, said John Henderson, chief executive of the Texas Organization of Rural and Community Hospitals. If you don't have the staff to do that, people are going to die. Staffing shortages are a serious concern in multiple regions. Intensive care unit nurses, who typically oversee no more than 2 patients at a time, are now being pushed to care for 6 to 8 patients to make up for the shortfalls in parts of Texas, said Robert Hancock, president of the Texas College of Emergency Physicians. In Ohio, some 20% of the 240 hospitals tied to the Ohio Health Hospital Association are reporting staffing shortages, according to spokesperson John Palmer. The American Hospital Association's Vice President of Quality and Patient Safety, Nancy Foster, said she's heard from 24 hospital leaders over the past 2 weeks, warning her of staffing shortages in states including Texas, North and South Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Illinois. Healthcare providers in Kansas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Ohio, Missouri, Michigan, and Utah said they're facing the same problem, as do local reports from New Mexico, Nebraska, Colorado, Wyoming, Tennessee, Georgia, Alabama, Indiana, Montana, California, Rhode Island, and South Carolina. It'd be easier if we just said, if you're not having a problem, please stand up. Oh my goodness. The shortages are primarily caused by overwhelming numbers of patients as coronavirus spreads, combined with decreased staffing levels as nurses and doctors themselves fall sick or have to quarantine after being exposed to infected people. COVID-19 is also prevalent in rural areas that have been struggling with a shortage of health professionals for years. Hospitals in more remote regions don't have equipment such as ventilators, and so must transfer severely ill patients to already overwhelmed urban healthcare systems. The scale of the problem makes it harder to address. Systems designed to offset shortages by bringing in backup from other areas don't work when so many states are affected simultaneously. States that sent doctors and nurses to New York at the beginning of the pandemic now have no one to turn to as hospitals across the country experience the same problems. Early on, Texas was sending teams of caregivers to states like New York to help with their surge, said Henderson. You can't do that when 48 states are going through a surge in the wrong direction. They all need help. Where do you pull from? As the crisis proliferates, several healthcare systems are struggling to transfer urgent patients to hospitals with adequate support. Hospitals in Lubbock, Texas had to send severe COVID-19 patients to Arizona, said Henderson. A Missouri patient who urgently needed surgery to remove a mass in his brain was sent to a hospital in Iowa, said Alex Garza, head of the St. Louis Regional Pandemic Task Force and community health officer at SSM Health in St. Louis. The mechanics of how you transport and accelerate care are broken at the moment, said Henderson. Even major cities in Texas, such as Houston, Dallas, and Austin, are facing their own staff limitations, and so many rural hospitals in Texas are forced to try and treat patients that they would typically transfer out. COVID-19 has so overwhelmed parts of Texas, including El Paso and Lubbock, that hospitals are running short of both beds and staff. I treated a clinical patient in a recliner because it was the only thing close to a bed we could find, said Hancock, who works at hospitals in Oklahoma, Dallas-Fort Worth, and Amarillo, Texas, but declined to say where the incident happened. We know the patient was sick and had nowhere to put them. You look at what resources you've got and make it happen. The lack of staff reflects a dramatic increase in patients. There's been an average of 157,000 new cases per day over the past week, according to the Stat COVID-19 tracker, 74% more than 2 weeks ago. And there simply aren't enough ICU nurses, in particular, to meet the need. Hospitals currently have 2,000 ICU nurse jobs open on Trusted Health, a company that connects travel nurses who hop from job to job around the country with hospitals. The situation is exacerbated as staff get sick with coronavirus themselves or else have to quarantine after exposure. The staffing need is so dire, hospital workers who have tested positive for COVID-19 but are asymptomatic have been told to continue working in North Dakota. One rural hospital in Texas is struggling with 30% of staff nurses out of commission because of infection with or exposure to COVID-19. At one point earlier this month, more than 1,000 staff from the Mayo Clinic were out of work because of COVID-19, said Amy Williams, executive dean at Mayo Clinic Practice. It could be caring for a family member who has COVID. It could be on quarantine because of being exposed in the community, or it could be because a staff member actually has COVID, Williams said. More than 90% of possible exposures occurred in the community as transmission picked up, she said, not in the hospital. As healthcare systems compete for additional staff, salaries skyrocket. ICU nurses are a hot commodity, said Dan Weberg, a former emergency room nurse and head of clinical innovation at Trusted Health, and their fees are currently twice as much as pre-COVID rates at around $5,000 to $6,000 per week. This is how PPE was in the beginning of the pandemic. When you're competing with everyone else in town, and state and the country, that creates a market that's not sustainable. In response to the staffing shortage, several hospitals are postponing elective surgeries, as many did in the spring at the start of the pandemic. This decision carries risks. They call them elective, but a lot are what I'd call urgent cases, said Hancock, the Texas emergency physician. A surgeon recently had to cancel two intestinal surgeries for patients who were struggling to eat, said Kenzie Graves, Associate Chief Medical Officer at University of Utah Health. Patients waiting for knee surgeries may well struggle to walk. But there are few alternatives for healthcare systems. You can always add more beds. It's much more difficult to add more workforce, said Alan Morgan, Chief Executive of the National Rural Health Association. Some hospitals are turning to local dentists and Red Cross volunteers and people with basic health experience to help with tasks that require less training, and said the American Hospital Association's Foster. The only other option is to ask existing staff to work more hours. University of Utah Health has been using additional ICU beds for months, which means nurses and providers are working extra shifts. Our numbers keep increasing, but they are tired. Our nurses feel like there's no end in sight, said Graves. They get here, work 12-hour shifts in PPE. It's just this churn of seeing critically ill patients. And then you go to your community and see peak numbers and having people continue to go to bars and restaurants. Trusted Health is trying to set a maximum of 60 hours per week in its nursing contracts. After working more than three 12-hour shifts in a row, error rates go up exponentially, said Weberg. What most worries hospital officials is that COVID-19 has not yet reached its peak. What I'm scared of leading up to the holidays is what's going to happen immediately after Thanksgiving, said Hancock. Then everyone gets into a crisis situation and there's nobody who can go help. The only hope is our demand for their only hope is for demand to decrease by people reducing COVID-19 transmission through quarantining and wearing masks, they said. Many of us feel powerless because we feel people aren't listening when we say don't gather for Thanksgiving or Christmas, said Graves. After months of dealing with the crisis, she worries that some nurses will be so burned out they'll quit, making the staffing shortage even worse. Both hospitalizations and deaths are lagging indicators, meaning it takes a couple of weeks for newly diagnosed cases to translate into more ICU patients. We're in for a very rough Thanksgiving and Christmas, said Henderson. Okay, and similar coverage, this from The Atlantic. Hospitals know what's coming. Perhaps no hospital in the United States was better prepared for a pandemic than the University of Nebraska Medical Center in Omaha. After the SARS outbreak in 2003, its staff began specifically preparing for emerging infections. The center has the nation's only federal quarantine facility and its largest biocontainment unit, which cared for airlifted Ebola patients in 2014. The people on staff had detailed pandemic plans. They ran drills. Ron Klain, who was President Barack Obama's Ebola czar and will be Joe Biden's chief of staff in the White House, once told me that University of Nebraska Medical Center is arguably the best in the country at handling dangerous and unusual diseases. There's a reason many of the Americans who were airlifted from the Diamond Princess cruise ship in February were sent there. In the past 2 weeks, the hospitals had to convert an entire building into a COVID-19 tower from the top down. It now has 10 COVID-19 units, each taking up an entire hospital floor. Three of the units provide intensive care to the very sickest people, several of whom die every day. One unit solely provides comfort care to COVID-19 patients who are certain to die. We've never had to do anything like this, Angela Hewitt, the infectious disease specialist who directs the hospital's COVID-19 team, told me. We are on an absolutely catastrophic path. To hear such talk from someone at University of Nebraska Medical Center, the best prepared of America's hospitals, should shake the entire nation. In mid-March, when just 18 Nebraskans had tested positive for COVID-19, Shelley Schweldhelm, the head of the hospital's emergency preparedness program, sounded gently confident. Or, at least she told me, I'm confident in having a plan. She hoped the hospital wouldn't hit capacity because people have done the right thing by staying home, she said. And people did. For a while, the U.S. flattened the curve. But now about 2,400 Nebraskans are testing positive for COVID-19 every single day, a rate five times higher than in the spring. More than 20% of tests are coming back positive, and up to 70% in some rural counties, signs that many infections aren't being detected. The number of people who have been hospitalized with the disease has tripled in just 6 weeks. The medical center is fuller with COVID-19 patients, and patients full stop than it has ever been. We're watching a system breaking in front of us, and we're helpless to stop it, says Kelly Caucut, an infectious disease and critical care physician. Caucut knows what's coming. Throughout the pandemic, hospitalizations have lagged behind cases by about 12 days. Over the past 12 days, the total number of confirmed cases in Nebraska has risen from 82,400 to 109,280. That rise represents a wave of patients that will slam into an already beleaguered hospital system between now and Thanksgiving. I don't see how we avoid becoming overwhelmed, said Dan Johnson, a critical care doctor. People need to know that the assumption we will always have a hospital for them is a false one. What makes this nightmare worse, he adds, is that it was preventable. The coronavirus is not unstoppable, as some have suggested, and as New Zealand, Iceland, Australia, and Hong Kong have resoundingly disproved twice. Instead, the Trump administration never mounted a serious effort to stop it. Whether through gross incompetence or deliberate strategy, the president and his advisors left the virus to run amok, allowed Americans to get sick, and punted the consequences to the healthcare system. And they did so repeatedly. Even after the ordeal in the spring, after the playbook for controlling the virus became clear, and despite months of warnings about a fall surge, not even the best prepared hospital can compensate for an unchecked pandemic. The University of Nebraska's medical center's preparations didn't fail so much as the U.S. created a situation in which hospitals could not possibly succeed. We can prepare over and over for a wave of patients, said Caucott, but we can't prepare for a tsunami. Speaking last Tuesday afternoon, Nebraska Governor Pete Ricketts once again refused to issue a statewide mask mandate. He promised to tighten restrictions once a quarter of the state's beds are filled with COVID-19 patients. But even then, some restaurants will still offer indoor dining, gyms and churches will remain open, and groups of 10 people will still be able to gather in closed spaces. Ricketts urged Nebraskans to avoid close contact, confined areas, and crowds, but his policies nullify his pleas. People have the mistaken belief that if the government allows them to do something, it is safe to do so, Johnson said. Well, I don't know if we actually need reminding, but I will point out this reminder. There are a lot of uninsured and underinsured people, and medical costs is still the leading cause of bankruptcy, has been for years and years and years and years. There are people who, even in the best of times during this pandemic, will be very reluctant to seek medical care because of the cost involved. But now that the healthcare system itself is having to triage people, whether they can even get admitted, or whether they can move from the emergency room to a bed, or from a hospital bed to an ICU, or from a hospital to a hospital farther away, the fact that we do not have universal healthcare is only going to be a concomitant tragedy. And yet, I hope for it.
It started in Norway in 1912. And they won't stop until everybody has healthcare. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get health care whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without healthcare. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Well, I hadn't run that PSA for a while, so I was glad to run that one. As timely as ever. Okay, well, of course, we all think that, you know, medicine is going to save us, but medicine is only a very small part of public health, and as far as the COVID pandemic, here's another story from Bloomberg. World Health Organization advises doctors not to use Gilead's remdesivir for COVID. The World Health Organization recommended against using Gilead Sciences' remdesivir to treat hospitalized COVID-19 patients less than a month after U.S. regulators granted the drug a speedy approval. There is currently no evidence that it improves survival or the need for ventilation, a panel of WHO-convened experts developing COVID-19 treatment guidelines said in the British Medical Journal. The recommendation is a blow to Gilead drug, which was one of the first thought to offer meaningful benefit in treatment of coronavirus patients after a study showed it reduced their recovery time. The antiviral has been used widely to treat COVID and was among the drugs President Donald Trump received when he was diagnosed with the disease in early October. The experts made the recommendation after results of a global trial sponsored by the World Health Organization called Solidarity found last month that remdesivir didn't reduce deaths. They also reviewed data from three other trials and said the drug has, quote, no meaningful effect on the time it took patients to clinically improve. The Solidarity results were published October 15th. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved the drug a week later, basing its decision on a trial run by the National Institutes of Health that showed remdesivir reduced hospitalized patients' recovery time by 5 days. The World Health Organization experts wrote in the British Medical Journal that their findings shouldn't be interpreted to mean that remdesivir is ineffective, but that, quote, there is no evidence based on currently available data that it does improve patient-important outcomes. The limited evidence for using the drug was weighed alongside the relatively high cost and resource implications associated with remdesivir, which is given intravenously, they said in a press release. Okay, well, you've waited patiently for some good news. Thank you for doing that. Here it is. Going to close the show with this from Stat News. They've been following the science, how the COVID-19 pandemic has been curtailed in Cherokee Nation. While the United States flounders in its response to the coronavirus, another nation, one within our own borders, is faring much better. With a mask mandate in place in spring, free drive-through testing, hospitals well-stocked with PPE, and a small army of public health officers fully supported by their chief, the Cherokee Nation has been able to curtail its COVID-19 case and death rates, even as those numbers surge in surrounding Oklahoma, where the White House Coronavirus Task Force says spread is unyielding. Elsewhere in the U.S., tribal areas have been hit hard by the virus. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports that American Indian and Alaskan Native populations have case rates 3.5 times higher than that of white individuals. The Navajo Nation, where COVID testing, PPE, and sometimes even running water are in short supply, has seen nearly 13,000 cases and over 600 deaths among its roughly 170,000 citizens. The Cherokee Nation, with about 140,000 citizens on its reservation in northeastern Oklahoma, has reported just over 4,000 cases and only 33 deaths. It's dire, but what in the world would it look like if we weren't doing this work, said Lisa Pivek, Senior Director of Public Health for Cherokee Nation Health Services. Pivek leads a team that jumped into action in late February, holding coronavirus task force meetings twice a day, instituting procedures to screen thousands of employees, stockpiling PPE, protecting elders, ensuring food security, and educating residents in both English and the Cherokee language. With no guidance on contact tracing available from the CDC early in the pandemic, Pivek researched the World Health Organization's Ebola response to set up tracing protocols. After the first case appeared on the reservation March 24th, she made many of the contact tracing calls herself. She said the Cherokee Nation has seen no cases of workplace transmission. Sequoia High School, with rapid testing en masse, reopened for in-person learning this fall, and elective medical and dental procedures have been widely restored. The tribe's COVID response meets the approval of global health leaders. It's very impressive. It's a reminder of how much leadership matters and how even under difficult circumstances, with limited resources, you can make a huge difference, said Ashish Jha, Dean of the Brown University School of Public Health. It fits what I've seen in the world. You see countries like Vietnam. They're not a wealthy country, but they've been following the science and doing a great job. If the U.S. had acted as the Cherokee Nation did, we would be doing so much better, Jha added, with tens of thousands of fewer deaths and probably a much more robust economy. The Cherokee Nation mounted an earlier and more aggressive response than neighboring states that have waited months and are still waiting for a national response. Pivek and other Cherokee leaders remain incredulous at the continued lack of federal leadership. It's as if Russia had invaded the U.S. and the federal government said, every county should fend for itself, Pivek said. A citizen of the Cherokee Nation, Pivek has stewarded the tribe's public health program for nearly 30 years. In 2016, she helped the tribe become the first to be accredited credited by the Public Health Accreditation Board. She said she's inspired by none other than Wilma Mankiller, an activist who became the nation's first female principal chief in 1985. She inspired me to stand up and say we can determine our own destiny. We can determine how we run our government, and we can determine how we respond to the coronavirus, Pivik said. Pivik gives much credit to Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr., who leads the vast 14-county reservation, larger than Connecticut, in the rolling foothills of the Ozarks, land Cherokee citizens were forced to walk hundreds of miles to relocate to after the Indian Removal Act of 1830. A sign with Hoskin's mask-adorned face graces the entrance to Cherokee Nation headquarters. And to highlight the importance of mask, he recently approved the masking of a statue of Sequoia, saying the Cherokee statesman would have been the first to mask up to protect his people. I've never felt so much support as a public health professional, Pivik said of Hoskin. He always comes through for us. He always listens to science. Hoskin, who says he is sure masks have saved lives and misery, implemented a mandate requiring Cherokee citizens to wear masks indoors and outdoors when around others at the behest of his public health experts. The state of Oklahoma has yet to enact one. I admire Dr. Fauci. I feel I have several Dr. Faucis, Hoskin told STAT, referring to Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. We acknowledge early on we should defer to the expertise of our public health staff to let them do what they do best. The proper collection of data on Native American health in the U.S. has been notoriously poor, not so in the Cherokee Nation. Early on, tribal public health leaders created a COVID dashboard with a seven-day moving average based on one created by Ja and his former colleagues at the Harvard Global Health Institute. They track cases closely. Pivik and David Gahn, the Cherokee Nation's public health medical officer, have been working around the clock to figure out how best to present tribal COVID data and keep it updated. We just issued update number 255, she said. Hoskin also worked to ensure tribal healthcare workers would have enough PPE. It blew my mind that the wealthiest country on the planet would find itself short of PPE for its healthcare workers, he said. The nation has donated spare PPE to non-Native first responder agencies in Oklahoma and to the Navajo Nation. Haskins is now using CARES Act COVID-19 emergency funding to build and retrofit facilities so Cherokee workers can manufacture PPE, including N95 masks, locally. We don't want to be at the mercy of the U.S. failure to ensure our people are safe, Hoskins said. The mask mandate was on full display September 30th when U.S. Attorney General William Barr visited Hoskin in the Cherokee Nation capital, Tahlequah, just 4 days after he'd attended, unmasked, the White House Rose Garden ceremony for now-confirmed Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett that's become notorious as a likely COVID-19 superspreader event. But in meetings with Hoskin, to discuss a recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling establishing that tribal citizens should be tried in tribal courts, Barr wore a mask. We have no problem forcing our mask mandate, even on our attorney general, said Hoskin. Holders of history and culture, Cherokee elders are revered. The population of those for whom Cherokee is their first language is shrinking rapidly. When you're losing Cherokee speakers and artisans, you're losing more than your grandparents, said Bill John Baker, a former Cherokee Nation principal chief. You're losing what it means to be Cherokee. When it became clear the virus was putting older people at risk, the Cherokee Nation acted swiftly to protect them. In March, Hoskin declared a state of emergency and asked all citizens to help shield elders. The nation set up a Cherokee language COVID hotline for first language speakers, delivered meals, and offered all citizens over 62 a $400 stipend to help with virus-related expenses. At Cherokee Nation, putting elders first is simply our way of life. The coordinated and rapid response of the Cherokee Nation was possible, Pivik said, because it builds on a strong healthcare system, the nation's largest tribal health system, that has been decades in the making. Many credit former Chief Baker for the transformation. One of Baker's first actions that when he took office in 2012 was to sell the tribe's $1.5 million private jet to help pay for medical services. He also directed hundreds of millions of tribal profits in recent years toward healthcare projects, upgrading many rural clinics, and commissioning a state-of-the-art outpatient facility that opened last year with specialized ventilation and the ability to separate patients, features that have proven extremely useful during the pandemic. The U.S. government is obligated by treaty to provide medical care to members of all federally recognized tribes, but the Indian Health Service annual budget of about $5 billion is far less than the $37 billion the National Indian Health Board estimates it needed. So some tribes, including the Cherokee Nation, supplement Indian Health Service funding from their own treasuries. Like many healthcare workers in the Cherokee Nation, they are Cherokee citizens. Nationwide, less than 1% of physicians are Native American. At the Cherokee Nation, 27% of physicians are tribally affiliated, and the tribe hopes to increase that number further. The Cherokee Nation is erecting a medical school building and launched a partnership with the Oklahoma State University College of Osteopathic Medicine to create the nation's first tribally affiliated medical school. More than 20% of students in the inaugural class that started this fall are Native American. Just as our ancestors grew their own teachers 150 years ago, Baker said, we want to grow our own doctors. While the tribe faces many challenges as cases rise on and off reservation land, among them asking people who are used to congregating in large family gatherings to stay apart, Pivik said she's proud to see how much the practices she and her team have put in place, how much they've helped. The Cherokee Nation, it seems, may have lessons for all of us. I hope our response as a nation demonstrates what being a tribe means, Pivik said. It's collectively caring for one another. Okay, folks, well, those are the kind of story you only will get here on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. If you're going to listen to an hour of COVID news, this is the place to get it from. Okay, well, I want to close with a special PSA regarding WAKT. While many are suffering from a loss of connection amid the pandemic, WAKT is working hard to counter that by fostering connections between Toledoans. By providing a platform for local talent to be heard by the public, our station is working hard to put the community in community radio. Unfortunately, the pandemic has hampered our ability to fundraise, and that's why we need your help. Beginning on December 1st, which is Giving Tuesday, we will be launching a donation drive with the goal of raising $3,000 for the station. This will ensure that all of our licensing insurance is covered and that we continue to be a way for Toledoans to connect with each other. Please set aside money now in preparation for our launch. In exchange for your contribution, we'll be providing a number of thank you items, including copies of our compilation album of local musicians, the Quarantine Sessions, a chapbook of local writers, homegrown Toledo creatives, and prints from local artists like Chris Rodriguez, Hannah Starseed, and Dawn Bucklew. Mark your calendar and prepare to make your donation on Tuesday, December 1st at www.toledoradio.org. And please note, if we have a successful fundraising drive, my salary will be tripled from zero to, oh, let me get my calculator out just to make sure. Three times zero equals zero. Okay, well, I'm good with that. And remember, you can listen to WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo online anytime at www.toledoradio.org. Okay, that does it for the show. If you have any questions or comments, please feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. That's T-O-P-P-U-N.com. Or you can queue up new shows as they come online, even before air date, at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Or look up Just for the Health of It, WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo on Facebook for the Facebook page to get notifications. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.